Our guest today is Laura Flynn. She was born and raised in San Francisco, California. She received her BA from Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, and her MFA in creative writing from the University of Minnesota, where she served as the inaugural fellow in the Scribe for Human Rights Project, a jointly sponsored project by the Human Rights and the Creative Writing Programs at the University of Minnesota. She's been an activist and a human rights advocate all her adult life. She lived in Haiti from 1994 to 2000 and remains deeply involved in the struggle for democracy and human dignity in that country. She is the editor of Eyes of the Heart, Seeking a Path for the Poor in the Age of Globalization by Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Common Courage Press, 2000. She currently teaches editing at the University of Minnesota and lives in Minneapolis with her husband, poet Michael Rollin. She is the author of Swallow the Ocean, which is a memoir of growing up in the face of her mother's catastrophic illness, which has just recently been published by Counterpoint Press. And she'll be reading from that today with us and taking your questions. So please join me in welcoming Laura Flynn.
Thank you. It's great to be here today. This memoir is a story of my childhood growing up in San Francisco. My mother has been mentally ill for most of my life. She was eventually diagnosed with schizophrenia. When I was very young, I had no idea that she was ill, and in fact, she was quite. But when I was young, she really didn't show any signs of that illness. It came on gradually. And so my early memories of childhood are very positive, almost idyllic in some ways. And we lived in San Francisco. I have two sisters, a younger sister, Amy, who's 3 years younger, an older sister, Sarah, who's 3 years older. And I thought I would just start by reading. I'm going to read a chapter out of the book. It's not the first chapter, so I may have to set this up a little bit. But read this chapter of the book. And then after that, I'll take questions from people if they have them. So this is about 60 pages into the book, and this is the point at which my mother was really first starting to show signs of her illness. We were living, as I say, in San Francisco, and it's about 1974. At this time, my parents divorced, but at this time, my family was still together, and I was certainly not aware, particularly, that anything was wrong with my mother, but she was starting to kind of descend into her own world. I think that's probably all I need to tell you. My father's business, he was in real estate. He sold buildings, and I think that comes up in this chapter, but just for clarity. Okay. All that year, my mother would sit in a high-backed armchair by the window in the living room, her legs tucked up under her. A well-worn paperback on telepathy or Edgar Cayce or transcendental meditation rested open on the arm of the chair. She studied the paranormal, reincarnation, Ouija boards, the lost island of Atlantis. She read Cayce again and again. I can imagine how she felt when the words of the books she read first sprang off the page, when they seemed to speak directly to her. For her, it must have been that much more intense, more powerful than anything she'd ever known before, gaining speed and frequency until eventually she didn't need to read. The trail of words continued in her head. And then she spent her days chasing the flushed colors of her thoughts. And it was not a question of not seeing the forest for the trees, because she saw all that. The pine needles, the branches, the trunks, and the forest. Beyond that, she saw the way the light flooded the forest canopy, and then the even deeper, untold meaning, the connection of the trees to the light and the branches to the needles. Everything was revealed, unspeakable, because the problem was that the speed of thought was so much faster than the speed of words, the senses faster than thought, the speed of light faster still. And words hopelessly lumbering behind. There was sound, there was vision, there was light, and then there were voices close by. As she looked out across the cluttered room, everything she saw was alert with meaning. The royal blue of the carpets she had chosen, the orange of the bridge through the windows, the fog just beginning to stream up the bay. A world of color too bold, sound too sharp, every sensation overwrought. Sometimes beautiful, sometimes terrible. Was it easier for her when the fog rolled in for the afternoons, blanching the brilliant light? She felt waves of power streaming from every object in that room, the clothes she wore, the food she ate, the things people gave her, the things she gave them. The objects around her created a current so complex, sometimes she could not navigate the room. Even if she wanted to go and stand at the window, she could not. She was locked in the tight embrace of the chair. Garbage was a terrible vulnerability. The mail, an unending burden. Bills, solicitations, junk mail, newspapers. They kept coming, and she could throw nothing away. The envelopes had her name, Mrs. Russell B. Flynn, printed in stark black ink across the front. She could not simply put them in the garbage and allow them to be taken away. To do so would open up a path that led straight back to her, a channel to her core. If matter could not be destroyed, how then could you ever extinguish the trails of influence that lingered on the things you touched? Forward and backward, we are linked in an unending chain, bound to everyone who's ever touched what we touch, to anyone who touches the things we touch after us. This is how evil circulates. This is how influence is exercised in the world. A battle was being waged, hidden from her before, hidden from other people still. The confirmation was in her dreams, on the television, in the newspapers. She'd always felt it, sensed a structure, a shape behind things. But now she knew. The world was in the thrall of a malevolent force. Proof. These battles on the street between young and old. Proof. Tear gas, riots, assassinations. Proof and flame, the war, babies running naked in the burning light. Proof. And no one had any idea who she was. A laugh slipped through her lips as she thought of this. Casey hadn't come this far. In the end, he'd been weak. She was stronger. Stronger than he'd ever been. She'd come to the source, the very source, and they had spoken to her. They had told her who she was. Her eyes fixed on the hummingbird, on a hummingbird hovering below the window. She rocked in the chair. Her arms held her breast tight against her chest. The motion brought her close to the source of her strength. She listened for the voices. Rocking, she entered the space before her. Rocking, space opened through the filtered light. Let it come, she thought. Let it come. At this time, my father's best friend Joe, married and with two daughters of his own, lived in Santa Rosa, about an hour north of San Francisco. Joe was the only person my father confided in about my mother's condition. Every couple of weeks, they'd meet at a bar halfway between Santa Rosa and San Francisco. Joe has described these conversations to me, my father running through his options, which seemed to be narrowing, and all seemed to be bad, while Joe listened, nodding, waiting for my father to slowly circle towards the decision he had clearly already made in his bones. I imagine them sitting in a booth in a darkened corner of the bar, drinking Heinekens in the dark green bottle. Sally's crazy, my father says. He said it so many times in so many ways, it draws no response from Joe. Both of them know by now that in addition to the things men generally mean when they say this about their wives, exasperation, incomprehension, this is also a statement of fact, the cold, hard truth. I'm the focus of her anger, my father says. If I leave, maybe she'll calm down. Joe nods. My father returns to his hope that my mother's family, her brothers and her parents, who are all living in Colorado now, will be shaken into action if he leaves. That her parents, with whom she talks by phone every week, and who have so far tended to view my mother's troubles as marital, not mental, would intervene and succeed where he has failed. Come out here and make her get some help. Not that he believes anymore. Really believes that anyone can make her get help. She was a fixed and stubborn woman when they met, and the more ill she becomes, the more unmovable she is. He's prodded, begged, and demanded that she see someone for the past 2 years, and nothing's moved her. Once, just once, he convinced her to let the minister from our church come over for a talk. The man sat on the living room couch facing my mother for 15 minutes, mildly suggesting some marital counseling. My mother exploded, then hounded him out the door. And then we stopped going to church, cutting off the last outlet, the last group of people outside our family with whom she'd had contact. My father came to a desperate two-part ultimatum. Get some help and clean up the house, or I'm leaving. It was now a full year later, and she'd barely roused herself from the living room chair. But still, I can't leave the girls, he says, shaking his head. For God's sake, how can I leave them there, he asks, as if Joe has any kind of answer to this. Taking us with him is not a real option. My father explains to me now, she was still so good with you guys. I couldn't imagine taking you away from her then. But mostly, he doesn't think of taking us because we are still more hers than his. She knows it, he knows it, and we know it. And then there are the circular, sodden questions that have to be asked until all hope is pounded out of them. She's so smart, for Christ's sake, he says. She's got to come out of this, don't you think? Joe says the reasonable things. Time, doctors, hospitals, medication. She's never taken a goddamn aspirin the whole time I've known her. Who the hell's going to get her to take medication? Before they leave, as he leans across the bar, waiting for his change, my father turns to Joe and says, she'll be okay for money, though. I'll always take care of that. My own memories of this time are sketchy. The main things are that the apartment was always messy, my mother was always home, and my father was always angry. The mess didn't bother me, though. But when my father came home from work, the piles of newspapers, the games and toys we'd played with and abandoned throughout the day, the dishes from our snacks in the living room, many more dishes piled in the sink in the kitchen, suddenly that looked bad. Clean up this goddamn mess, he'd say, glowering at us from the couch while we scampered around, snatching up our dolls, gathering Monopoly money, stashing newspapers and magazines under the TV cart. It didn't help. The mess was implacable, and so was his anger. Odd as it may seem, I don't remember being aware that anything was wrong with my mother. Perhaps that's because the one thing she kept up with was being a mother. She still got my sisters and me off to school each day, late, maybe, but off. Every day as I went out the back door with the lunch she'd made me in my hand, she'd say, "Be a good girl at school today," as if I were ever anything but. When I got home, she was there in the living room, in her chair, waiting, I thought. She still pored over my report cards and helped me with school projects. I took ballet lessons and she came to the recitals. She drove Sarah and me to the park every week for horseback riding lessons over the summer. She made dinner, and she read to us from the Bible every night. Some stories she returned to again and again. There in the new apartment, the three of us circled around her on the floor of the living room. She read us the story of Jacob's ladder. I don't remember exactly what she told us about this story, only that it mattered to her deeply. The images of Jacob climbing a ladder to the sky and wrestling with an angel all night have stayed with me to this day. Each night, she knelt with me and Amy by the side of our bunk beds in the room we shared. We recited the Lord's Prayer together. She kissed us and turned out the lights. She was never incoherent, and her anger, though scary, was aimed only at my father. She didn't yell at us back then. The fissure between my parents deepened. How could it not? They'd wrangled for years over the question of her getting help, and the harder he pushed, the more she backed away, eyeing him with suspicion all the while. As long as they'd been together, they'd woken each morning and told each other their dreams. By now, my mother used dreams, his and hers, to guide all decisions. My father says his dreams were by then so dark, so demon-haunted, he feared he would follow her right over the edge. That fear, more than anything, pushed him out the door. One morning, he told her he wasn't going to talk about dreams anymore. He wasn't even going to think about them. And he claims he didn't remember another dream for 15 years. But bad as this was for my father, my mother's terror must have been greater. She told me later she believed my father was the devil. Now, that's not quite right. She didn't use the word devil. She said he was on the side of evil, more a cohort, a higher up in the devil's minions. How does that happen? How do you come to believe your husband of 12 years is in league with the devil? Maybe it was one morning as she lay in bed watching him dress for work. Her eyes track him as he chooses a suit from the closet. He places the narrow tie around his neck. She examines the set of his jaw, the squint of his eyes, the shape of his hands as he knots the tie. Suddenly, she jolts forward in terror. He turns to her, his face a tight mask, and behind that, nothing. It's all she can do to remain still while he bends and places a glancing kiss on her forehead. He turns and walks from the room. He's withholding his dreams. He goes to work in a rush of anger and comes home silent, bringing that hardness into the house. He watches the news. He yells at the children. His lust for the deals he makes at work hangs like a moldy film on his body. His voice is metallic and hard, distant, as if he's in the next room, not right before her, telling her she needs help. She, who has struggled for his soul so long. She who has listened and interpreted for him, scouring both their dreams for signs. So many years doing the work for both of them, for all of them. And now, with every gesture, every step, he confirms it. He's crossed the line. And even then, once she knew, was his old face restored to her from time to time? Were there still mornings when they talked, nights when she turned to him and told him how frightened she was? And did their bodies still fit together in love? The front door closes behind him. She sits up. Enveloped in terror, she rocks slowly on the edge of the bed. He's made a deal. He's crossed the line. He's on the other side. He'll take her down. He'll take the children down, if she lets him. She does the only thing possible. She steels herself against him, draws the children in tight, and prepares for battle. My father remembers one last scene. He sat with my mother on a bench in Golden Gate Park in the late spring of 1974. My sisters and I were at school. He was home from work. In fact, he hadn't worked much that year, hadn't closed a deal, hadn't earned a dime in months. "Sally," he said, "I can tell you exactly what's going to happen." She didn't look at him. "First, you're going to lose me," he said. "Then I'm going to take the children." She turned slightly. Her gaze flickered over him. "You'll lose the house," he went on. "You'll end up living in one of my buildings in the Tenderloin." She shook her head. She almost laughed. She didn't argue. Everything he said was beside the point. Her mind was fixed on something else altogether. And then, turning full on him, her eyes focusing in for just a second, she said sharply, "No one will ever give you the children." On the day my father finally moved out, after he'd shuttled his suitcases to the car and the front door closed behind him, my mother turned to us and said, "There goes a very bad man." Her words startled me, but I didn't doubt her. Doubting her was not yet a part of my makeup. And now that she said it, now that she put it that way, it did seem true. He hadn't been very nice in a very long time, and he was leaving us. That was bad. My mother sat up tall in her high-backed gold armchair and spoke almost without malice. She was calm, surprisingly so under the circumstances. My sisters and I sat across from her, lined up on the living room couch. It was the first day of summer between second and third grade. I don't remember the days that led up to this one, if there had been more fights. Surely there were. Or if I'd known ahead of time he was leaving. Just this scene, my father carrying suitcases out to his car, my sisters and I very quiet on the couch. He came back to kiss each of us on the forehead before he left. But I didn't look him in the eye. My mother's coiled anger trumped whatever sympathy I had for him. Trumped everything, in fact. When the door closed, I turned to look out the window behind me and caught the back of my father's head, craning slightly forward as he walked down the staircase to the street. He wore a corduroy jacket, lemon-colored, with patches at the elbows. And for a second, I saw the spot at the top of his head where, at 34, His scalp was just beginning to show through. "A very bad man," she repeated, with a rapid movement of her head that shook the dark loose curls of her hair. "This summer we will erase the past," my mother said after he drove away. She held up her arm, an imaginary eraser in her hand, and swept the air in front of her. "We'll wipe the slate clean." We sat there for a very long time that day. My mother laid out the new terms of our lives. They had to do with staying inside and cutting all our ties to other people, with being very careful about what we ate and what we wore. Across town, in the one-bedroom apartment he'd rented the week before, my father, whom I've never seen shed more than a few tears, cried for 2 days. From my perch on the living room couch, I watched the fog flow in like a second body of water over the bay. When it was rolling in, I could see where it ended, where it began. I could watch its shape change as it came slowly towards us. First, the bridge disappeared, then the trees in the Presidio, then the houses and street down below. And then suddenly, there was nothing to see. The fog was just a white melancholy that hung in the air, punctuated by the double wail of the foghorns, low and lower, moaning through the afternoon. Gazing into the distantless space, there was no way to know the whole world wasn't like that, muffled and dim, shrouded in white. So that's all I'm going to read. And I'd be happy to take any questions if people have them. Yeah. The title of the book? It's from a story, supposedly a Chinese folk tale. I'm not actually sure if it's Chinese, but it was a story I read as a child about five Chinese brothers, and the oldest one could swallow the ocean. And the story's in the book, but basically the first brother could swallow the ocean, and there was a little boy who ran out to gather the fish, and then the little boy was supposed to run in, and the brother couldn't hold the water anymore, and he let it out, and the boy died, and then eventually the brothers killed. But anyway, it was a strange story that stuck in my mind, and when I started writing the book, I started thinking about it, and I never considered it for a title until I was almost done. But for some reason, I was very drawn to that story, and I dug it out of the library in San Francisco when I was first writing the book, and it just had some kind of hold on me. So, and then it ended up far later to be a great, I thought, a good title for the whole story. Yeah.
How long did it take for you to write the book?
It took me about 6 years to write. Yeah. When I started it, I thought it would take me about 6 months, you know, and that wasn't how it worked. And, you know, I did a lot of other things in between. I was working, and then I ended up going to grad school. But altogether, yeah, from the time I started, it was about 6 years. So many, many, many drafts. It's not that long. It's less than 300 pages, but that's what it took. So, yeah.
What was it like writing about your family? I mean, obviously, there are the people that are very close to you and that you know well, but at the same time, I think it can be difficult to share with everyone those kind of tragic things that you know about them.
Yeah, I think it was certainly my major fear when I started writing the book, and I considered writing it as fiction. To protect them in some way, or, you know, because I was worried that they would be upset, my sisters and my father particularly. But as I wrote, I felt that there was something that just wasn't, that I really needed to tell the story as it had happened, and that I wanted to be faithful. I wanted to write about this experience in a way that might help people understand, and to do that, it seemed best to really tell my own story exactly as it happened, to not change it or turn it into fiction. So then I kind of had to, you know, face my family and let them know I was doing this. And I guess it was really kind of a long process in the beginning. You know, they were, fortunately, it took me a really long time to write the book. So we had a lot of time to talk about it and for them to adjust to it. And I would say that they're mostly, I mean, they're very supportive. They were very supportive. They helped me a lot with memory, you know, especially my dad remembering what actually happened and dates and times. And, you know, I don't know if they would have absolutely chosen to have the book be written, you know, because, you know, I chose that. They didn't, but they haven't, they never outright objected. And I think at this point they've come around to it also. So, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, there are many different books that helped me. One of the books that I had read it a long time before I even started writing this book, but Madeline Robinson's Housekeeping. I don't know if people know it, but it's a work of fiction, but it has a certain memoiristic quality of it. It feels like it's being told by someone. It's a childhood story, and there are two sisters, and they're in sort of, it's not exactly comparable situation, but in a somewhat disordered family situation. And there was just something about that book that managed to deal with very hard issues in a way that didn't feel entirely grim, that captured my attention. And also she's a beautiful writer. But then other books, I mean, I read Janet Frame's books about her experiences with her own mental illness, which were really helpful to me in thinking about, well, one, to get a little more insight into that experience. The section I read from my mother's point of view, sort of I took that from both things I knew about her, but also from readings I did from people who'd had similar experiences themselves. So that, and then, I mean, endless numbers of books helped me. This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff, which is not a similar story at all, but there was a lot about that book that really shaped my writing, trying to write as... to give people, you know, to write in the scene and in the moment as deeply as possible so that you don't just feel like you're being told a story at a distance, but actually creating scenes and letting the reader see the situation from a child's eye point of view. So that was another thing I took from that. Yeah. Yes?
I thought of the book Glass Castle when I was listening to you read. Have you read that?
I haven't read it. I know I should read it, but yeah.
No,
it's not The Glass Castle? No, it's a memoir also. Yeah, I think it's.
I mean, I was thinking about it as I was thinking.
Yeah.
I need to read it. What did you do to write your story?
Well, I guess I always knew that I would write, but I wasn't really planning to write this. I had lived overseas for about 5 years, and I came back and was planning to write about that in a really different kind of much more political story, much more kind of cultural and, you know, about living in another country, and sort of as I started writing, sort of all these things from my childhood started coming back, not in a like bad way, but just memories, and a lot of them were really good memories. And I kind of felt, well, one of the things I started thinking about was all these doll games that my sisters and I had played when we were children. And I think, and they were kind of this magical place that we created when we lived with my mother after my father moved out. She would often not let us leave the house for long periods of time. And so we created this kind of fantasy world. And as I remembered the actual stories of those games, I started feeling like, well, there's a lot about this story that isn't grim or terrible. I mean, you carry sort of an unhappy childhood. You don't think anyone wants to read about it. And so I think that helped me to see, like, actually this could be, there's a lot more to this story, and this could be something I would actually enjoy writing. So I think that kind of shifted things for me. It was probably also, you know, I was in my like early 30s, and I think maybe I was old enough to approach it. I don't think I could have written about it when I was younger. So, yeah.
Could you say a little bit about the writing process itself for you? Because I know that you said you were an editor.
Uh-huh.
The person that introduced you, you said you were an editor. Did you edit your work endlessly as you were going along, or were you able to pretty much do the draft and then come back at least chapter by chapter? How did you do that?
I edit pretty much constantly. That's just the way I write, and then the next day I'll look at what I wrote and I'll put a little more in it, or I'll cut some more, and then I'll do that over and over and over. So I don't really write through, and then eventually you have something that looks like a chapter and you can edit that, you know, and then piece by piece. And, you know, for a long time, the chapters or the pieces were not organized or sequential. You know, I had different, I really started with what came to the surface, the most powerful scenes, and then fleshed them out, and then figured out how they would go together. And so, yeah. But people will say, oh, I write 3 pages a day, and I can't imagine what that's like, because I write 3 pages a day, and then I write the same 3 pages, and then I write, so it doesn't, you know, yeah. No, what, I mean, I was very lucky once it was difficult to write. And I think I did contact an agent early on, like a couple of years into it, and I sent some stuff to them. And the response wasn't very good. And I think I wasn't, I was just asking him what he thought. But of course, he took it very seriously, like, no, I would not be able to publish this. And but that was really because I was doing that too early. I think I wasn't ready, and the book wasn't anywhere near being done. So when I finally finished it, it was actually my MFA thesis, and being in a graduate program helped me. I'd been working on the book for a couple of years, and I realized it was going to take me a couple more years to finish, and I decided it would be great to have an MFA also. As long as I was going to be doing this, I might as well get a degree too and have a structure to work within. So then that gave me a kind of time, and I decided I absolutely would finish the book for the thesis, and I did. And then I sent the book out to several agents. It took about 4 or 5 months to find someone who would represent me. And then in another, by 4 or 5 months, she was able to sell the book to Counterpoint. So fairly smooth. I mean, you know, like the bad part was that the Counterpoint was actually then sold shortly after I sold the book to them. And my editor was fired. She had like 2 weeks notice, and she was the editor-in-chief, and they were in New York, and they ended up, they now are in Berkeley, so it's a completely different company, but it turned out well, because the new people were also very supportive, and the book's set in San Francisco, so the connection to the Bay Area is actually probably a pretty good thing, so, yeah, sure. Any other questions?
Have you ever done any writing where you weren't able to talk to the people, like a research-driven thing? And if so, how do you flesh out something that you just dig out of references and books?
So you mean nonfiction writing, but based on
yeah.
real events, but where you can't, you don't know it.
How do you put a person behind it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure I've exactly done that. There were parts of the book that I wrote about my parents' youth that was partly imagined, you know. But and I did research on the times and the places and tried to imagine it. But I knew them, so I could kind of insert their personalities into that. I haven't really done that kind of writing. But I mean, I think the main thing with writing nonfiction that may be historical or very fact-driven is that you have to bring the same liveliness of language to that work that you would bring to something that might feel more literary or compelling. You know, so if you're conveying a lot of information, you have to find a way to do it that doesn't feel like you're conveying a lot of information. I mean, that's all I can say about that. But yes.
Do you feel like the writing of this book has changed kind of where you moved in life and where you've ended up and where you're going?
Yeah. Certainly it opened this experience up. You know, even when I started writing about it, I don't think I would have, I can remember when I first started writing, people would say, what are you writing about? And I would say, oh, it's a book based on my family history or something. But I would not say, you know, my mother was meant to, I just didn't offer that information up very willingly. And at this point, it's out there, you know, it's like, it's on the back of the book, it's, you know, it's doing interviews and everything. So over those 6 years, I think, and the process of writing made it possible to not feel all of that kind of tightness or shame around the issue, and I think that's a huge benefit of the book. It brought me to Minnesota because I came here to go to graduate school, and I didn't expect to do that at all, so that was a big change. So.
Is your mother still living?
She is. She's still alive. I see her occasionally. She's pretty much completely isolated and lives on her own and has had a very limited kind of has lived that way for the past 25 years. So that's in the book, too, the end of the book. Yeah. No, she didn't. No, she did not ever take medication. And at the time, it was the late 1970s, and it It was not legally possible to force someone into treatment. Some things have changed now, although it's still very complicated, but she absolutely refused ever to have any kind of treatment. And the time, you know, at that time in the late 70s, there was a really strong movement to sort of let people out of hospitals and an anti-psychiatry movement, which had some basis because the hospitals were really pretty terrible. But at the same time, there was a kind of total lack of mental health care. And there still is, but I think things have improved. So, no, she refused to ever have treatment, and she hasn't had any medication, which is not that rare. People assume that everybody gets medication, and it's not really true. I think there are some studies that show that maybe as much as 50% of people with schizophrenia don't get any kind of treatment. So, yeah. No, she doesn't know I wrote the book. She's, I've never told her. She's not the person that she was, like, mentally. I mean, it's a very limited kind of contact we have with her. And at this point, she doesn't even leave her apartment, so there's no way she would find out about it, and I can't imagine telling her, so. Yeah, I met my husband in graduate school, and now I'm stuck here in this cold place, but, you know. But I love it, too. So I've been here for about 4.5 years, and we actually just made an offer on a house today, so I guess we're staying. And we're having children. I'm pregnant, so that's why. Yeah, I am. I'm working on a book about Haiti, about my experiences in Haiti, and so that'll be a completely different book, and see. I don't know. It's also hard, but for different reasons, so. Yeah. Okay. Oh, yes. No, that's okay.
So you're
writing,
you were writing Haiti.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself ever doing fiction, or do you
want to
stick with the nonfiction?
I'm kind of torn. In fact, the book about Haiti, I've almost in the same way I did with the other book, played with the idea of making it fictional, and I'm still not convinced. Yeah, I would like to write fiction. I don't totally have as much confidence because I feel like the strength of my writing usually comes from describing a lived experience. And I'm just not sure. I feel like my fiction is not as convincing. And so I'm not sure if I'm able to sort of let that go, you know. I mean, there's plenty to write about in nonfiction, even if I, you know, it doesn't have to all be from my life, but there are other things that I could certainly write about. So I don't know. I mean, I love nonfiction. I would really like to try writing a novel, though. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much. You've been a great audience.